Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And I want to talk today a little bit more about the Indian partition. There have been a couple of podcasts I've done on this subject, but I want to kind of drill down and look at a kind of a micro picture in the partition. We normally look at the big picture. I want to look more at specifically at Calcutta today and what happens there in 1946. So this is prior to the actual physical partition taking place, but it's during a period of partition. I think you can probably look at the tensions of partition all the way back into the mid-war period, and there are particular changes that take place in 1946 that make intercommunal violence occur long before the British start to carve up the map in that arbitrary manner. So British rule takes quite a blow in March 1946 when the Congress Party wins the elections of that year, and it becomes clear that Britain will be leaving India a lot quicker than they had envisaged. So the timetable for withdrawal from India and also working out the shape of the new India and the political settlement for the new India, what that's going to look like, that has to be done in a much, much smaller frame. Also, Britain can no longer rely on the Indian Army. The Indian Army used to be a great tool of power in Asia to deal with the Burmese or the Malays or the Chinese or anybody else who was causing trouble, really, between the Suez and Shanghai. So that's gone, and the loss of the Indian Army meant that Britain, the rest of Britain's Asian colonies, were now severely in peril. There were not enough British soldiers to do the task of policing Asia. Now, the Muslim League, despite having done well in the elections in particularly important areas such as some districts in the Punjab and obviously Bengal, which is majority Muslim, still is treated like a second-class citizen as a political party by the Congress Party. So the strategy that they envisaged, that Jinnah of the Muslim League envisaged, was to have strength within the majority Muslim provinces and to have to kind of undermine their future independent government in Delhi if partition didn't happen. And this would have led to a kind of a Balkan style India, where essentially there are autonomous regions with inter-ethnic tensions that would no doubt flare into violence. The concept of the creation of a Pakistan state had been around for quite some time. It had been around really since the start of the Second World War, And it's mentioned more and more as a clear alternative, this idea of a homeland for India's Muslims. The idea that independence will come in 1947 is not really a kind of a wide currency in 1946. But the questions over Pakistan: would Pakistan be part of an independent homeland, but be part of the same state? Would there be a state with two parliaments? Would Pakistan be a separate state with a similar, say, defence and foreign policy to India? None of this is clear. Also, the question of how to unite a large Muslim majority in the East and a Muslim majority in the West, with East Pakistan, West Pakistan, East Pakistan obviously becoming Bangladesh. By September that year, an interim government had formed, and this was intended to be the means by which transition to independence would occur. It was a Congress cabinet. There were only two Muslim League ministers who were involved, and the whole thing is mired in distrust and resentment. The Congress ministers take over most of the significant departments, particularly things such as police and the army, and you in essence get a Congress government of India and what would later be Pakistan. So this sets the scene really for the intercommunal violence that follows. In the predominantly Muslim Calcutta in the August of 1946, protests break out because of anger over the lack of status of the Muslim League within the new transitional government and the refusal of Congress to share power with Muhammad Ali Jinnah and the League. The protests are focused mainly against the British, whom the Muslims believe are really behind all of this. There's an assumption that Britain is setting up a Hindu India dominated client state in order to transition. The protests result in the death of 6,000 people, referred to historically as the Great Calcutta Killings, and they run until October 1946. So the killings actually, all the way until 1948, rise on a kind of a weekly basis. They have their kind of key period of violence up until October, but are ongoing for the next 2 years. The position of Bengal, of which Calcutta is obviously the capital, had been greatly affected by the war. There'd been a flow of refugees from Burma, mainly those who had been ethnic Indians in Burma, who'd fled Burmese nationalists during the war, the Burmese nationalists being allied to the Japanese. One of the first things that the Japanese allowed following their conquest of Burma was a kind of an inter-ethnic bloodletting and allowing the poor Burmese peasants to take out their frustrations on Indians who were normally of the kind of merchant or bureaucratic class. So there was a flow of these refugees into Bengal. Bengal had obviously suffered a famine during the war, which was in large part the fault of Britain's wartime administration. The chief minister of Bengal, H.S. Surawadi, who was partly responsible for the failures during the famine, began to attempt to assert Muslim political influence within Bengal, You also, the position, the figure of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, of whom I'll try to do a separate podcast on his own, because he's such a significant figure later on. He was accused of having a key involvement in stoking tensions within Calcutta, particularly calling for a day of action on the 16th of August that really triggers the killings. The purpose of the event was supposedly to protest against the British, but really the subtext of it was that it was a protest against the potential of future Hindu domination. On the street, political activists from the Muslim League and from the Mahasabha, which is the Hindu activist organisation, fought it out. The League points the finger at Congress and says, well, you're whipping up the troubles here in Calcutta, and Congress say vice versa and blame the Muslim League. Both sides organised strikes and civil disobedience. It's the Muslim shopkeepers and stall holders in the bazaars of Calcutta that suffer the most as a result of this, and lose trade and that sort of thing. And Jinnah's day of direct action fell in the middle of Ramadan. So it was at a period of intense religious sensitivities, obviously during the Muslim month of fasting. Congress was also planning a direct snub to the British. They were planning an Indian National Army Day. The Indian National Army obviously was the force created by Subhas Chandra Bose during the Second World War to fight alongside the Japanese against the British in the liberation of India, and the veterans of the army who were arrested by the British at the end of the war and put in jail were released fairly shortly after. The British made lots of catastrophic errors in attempting to try them for treason, and when large majority of them were acquitted and a few got a slap on the wrist, it was an indication that the Indian courts were no longer willing to uphold British rule in India judicially. It was a big blow to Britain's hopes to hang on to India. The majority of INA men were Hindu, and by 1946, Muslim youth groups and paramilitaries view the INA as essentially a Hindu organisation. They began to organise themselves in Calcutta. The Mohammedan Sporting Club was a particular example of a youth group that becomes paramilitary as a result. It's clear from the rhetoric of the Muslim League and their affiliated groups within Calcutta that they were preparing themselves for conflict. Talk of jihad was circulating. Jihad obviously meaning the struggle against evil. It doesn't necessarily mean to fight in a combative way at all. It can often mean an internal spiritual struggle. But it was interpreted by the Muslims of Calcutta as being a direct call to arms.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And a readiness to fight. The local newspapers, dominated by Hindus and for Hindu audiences, obviously interpret these pronouncements in mosques and in flyers to the Muslim community as a declaration of civil war and a declaration of war against Hindu people. A rally on August the 16th, 1946, for Calcutta's Muslims drew a crowd of 100,000, and the march to the rallying point took them through the Hindu districts of the city, where march leaders and agitators attempted to shut down Hindu stalls and force traders to shut up shop. And this is obviously where trouble breaks out, and this is provoked really by the activists within the Muslim crowd. However, there's another side to the story. There is eyewitnesses saw Hindu troublemakers throwing bricks on the Muslim crowd. So there appears to be kind of six of one and half a dozen of the other as to sort of who causes the first trouble. The Muslim men at the front of the column, the front of the march, were all armed with lattis, which were the steel-tipped canes ideal for whipping passers-by in a rather unpleasant manner. So they come ready for trouble. Once the violence on the 16th broke out, there's an interesting, or I say interesting, but it's a rather tragic transition of power. Local leaders, both Hindu and Muslim, lose the ability to calm the situation down. Power transitions from them to really local underworld figures who criminal figures who have far greater sway over the angry mob. And the attack and counterattack by both sides on Hindu temples and Muslim mosques become a regular part of life in Calcutta. The violence starts to radicalise. Initially, the idea that attacking women and children was seen as taboo and beyond the bounds of acceptable behaviour, that melts away, and neighbourhoods actually become wiped out in the violence. There are intercommunal killing. Entire districts are murdered by rival gangs. It's important to mention, of course, that India is awash with firearms at the end of the war. There were British soldiers who sold their old guns when close to being demobbed, and jaded British storemasters who frankly didn't care whether the guns fell into the hands of Hindu or Muslim mobs, and did obviously reasonably well out of it before they returned home to Great Britain. The civil authorities are completely overwhelmed. There aren't even enough people to collect the dead bodies lying in the streets and floating in the canals and by the roadsides. And the police, the number about 500, they're mainly unarmed. They can't do very much. They can exert a little bit of moral authority and tell the crowds to go home. But once they have dispersed, once they've gone, the crowds have dispersed, the crowds sort of return and violence begins again. And it is the murder of women and children that entrenches both sides yet further. The unforgivable nature of many of the crimes and the murder of Hindu priests and Muslim imams also helps to demonize the enemy and make them seem utterly irredeemable and beyond the pale. There's plenty of evidence that the INA had joined in the violence and had come specifically to Calcutta to perpetrate it. The fact that at least on one side there were trained fighting men gives us a clue as to why the outbreak of violence lasts for 3 months. There are people there who have fought for years on end against either the British or the Japanese and are skilled in waiting out long campaigns. Tellingly, no Europeans were injured in the fighting. There were a significant number of Europeans and Eurasian people living in Calcutta at the time. They are not targets. The initial cover story that the protests were direct against the British doesn't stand up to much close scrutiny, being as there were no British people on the receiving end of public anger. Instead, really, this is the beginnings of the battle to decide the future of India. And yet, when you get down to a very micro level, a very grassroots level, there are people killing their neighbours who are not even informed, whose actions are not even informed by that level of political analysis. It is simply that special madness, if you will, that takes hold in inter-ethnic violence where repressed resentments bubble out into almost unlimited hatreds, and the other social group or ethnic group that can be dehumanised is done so and murdered as a result. You get all sorts of ordinary people taking part in the killing. As I've just mentioned, there were demobbed soldiers and former Indian National Army men getting involved. But a lot of the killing is actually done by people who had never raised a hand to anybody. Some of the slum dwellers in Calcutta, who at this point were facing starvation, still become involved in murder. And even though British soldiers are quickly sent to patrol Calcutta along with Gurkhas, and one division of Indian soldiers, in total some 45,000 soldiers are deployed within 24 hours to Calcutta, this does not stop the violence. The British Army attempted to use rescue units to extricate Muslim or Hindu citizens trapped in unfriendly neighbourhoods, but would often arrive to find the people they were sent to rescue already murdered. The role of the British British Indian Gurkha force, in part, was to keep Calcutta going, was to keep essential services running, and to make sure that essential workers got to their jobs unmolested. And this was perhaps a greater priority than trying to deal with the inter-ethnic strife, which basically nobody knew how to deal with. The local Indian political elites and the viceroy Wavell had no clue as to put the kind of the genie back into the bottle of inter-ethnic violence, and it's possible that nobody would have been able to do that. Within 3 days of the outbreak of violence on August the 16th, 30,000 people had left the city, and some of them had been the same people that had fled Burma 4 years earlier. There was no indication that the violence was going to end, even following the evacuation. And over the next 2 years, something in the order of 20 to 30 people would die every single day on the streets of Calcutta. And following the outbreak of violence in Bengal, the Punjab would be the next state to explode into ethnic violence. The violence also had another tragic side effect, and that was an outbreak of cholera, as sewage, sanitation and clean drinking water all broke down. Key workers had been murdered and the installations had been destroyed in the violence. So this, combined with a virtual state of famine in the city, 190,000 people having to eat from canteens and soup kitchens, was part of the lasting legacy of the Calcutta violence. The other, of course, is the fact that for generations, Hindu and Muslim people never trusted each other in the city again. There was still, following partition, a large number of Muslim people that stayed behind in Calcutta, Calcutta being retained by India, not becoming part of the new state of Pakistan, or the eastern portion of Pakistan. And the violence would eventually overflow into the provinces of Bengal that became East Pakistan, and to the city of Dhaka, which would be the capital of East Pakistan, and later Bangladesh. The violence continued because obviously Bengal is a very diverse part of India, with a balkanized collection of Hindu and Muslim communities, and so Hindus were then persecuted by Muslims in East Pakistan as revenge for the killings in Calcutta. All of this happened in front of the British before they left India, and British magistrates, police officers and army officers were largely powerless to do anything at all, having long since lost their moral, political and indeed military and judicial authority in India. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and I will be in the next few weeks doing some cool stuff in a run-up to Christmas. We've got some new books to review, and we'll be doing a kind of a general roundup of the year. So stay tuned. There's some interesting stuff happening in the new year, which I'll let you know about in due course. Anyway, all the best, and I'll speak to you soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.